Esther 5, page 384. On the third day, so that's after she's agreed with Mordecai to go to the king and plead for God's people, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, in front of the king's quarters, while the king was sitting on his royal throne inside the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. And when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight, and he held out to Esther the royal scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter, and the king said to her, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given you even to the half of my kingdom." And the king doesn't mean that literally. That's a well-known saying. It's an expression that just means he's ready and willing to be really generous. Verse 4. And Esther said, "If it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I've prepared for the king." And the king said, "Bring Haman quickly so that we may do as Esther has asked." So the king and Haman came to the feast that Esther had prepared. And as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king said to Esther, "What is your wish? It shall be granted to you. What is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom it shall be fulfilled." Then Esther answered, "My wish and my request is, if I found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleased the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the feast that I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said." And Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and brought his friends and his wife Zeresh. And Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and the servants of the king. Then Haman said, "Even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast she prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her together with the king. Yet all this is worth nothing to me so long as I see Mordecai, the Jew, sitting at the king's gate." Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, "Let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then go joyfully with the king to the feast." This idea pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made. So this morning's passage breaks into two equal halves. We have two characters before us, okay? Esther and Haman. And they're each going to teach us a different way of living. Esther's going to show us the God-first approach to life. And then Haman is going to show us the me-first approach to life. They've both got a lot to teach us. So if you're taking notes on the back of the service program, first of all, let's learn from Esther. And the next slide should come up. There we go. Esther. Picture the scene. And this includes you, kids. And if you need to, shut your eyes to picture it really vividly. You're walking down a long marble corridor in a palace with massive marble pillars towering up either side of you, and there are burning torches in the brackets on the walls. And after a few minutes, you eventually get to this huge, ornate doorway with thick oak doors that are wide open. And either side of the doorway are heavily armed guards in plumed helmets. They're brandishing swords. They've got spears. And they're watching you intently. And as you pause, you can see them assessing that you're not a security threat. But still, you can't help swallowing hard, and you feel yourself starting to sweat. And then you make a big decision in your mind. And you swallow, and then you walk through the doorway. And as you walk past the guards through the doorway, you can see them giving you a double take and glancing at each other in surprise, and then shrugging with a mean grin and letting you go. Well, the other side of the doorway, you turn a corner, and suddenly you find yourself standing before a massive marble throne with steps leading up to it. And it's covered in ornate gold and silver, and there are tame leopards chained around it. And either side of the throne are small groups of men, all in magnificent robes. They're talking to each other. You can hear the hubbub of conversation. And on the throne, as you look up, is a figure sitting. And he's in even more magnificent robes, and on his head is glinting a gigantic golden crown. But as soon as you enter the room suddenly falls silent. All the conversation stops, and you realize everyone has turned to stare at you. And then you notice behind the king on the throne and slightly to one side is another guard, but this guy is a monster of a man, 6'8", 300 pounds of pure muscle, and he's brandishing a gigantic axe in front of him. And as he sees you, he tightens his grip on the axe, and he turns to look at the king as if waiting for a signal. And there's a long pause, and your heart starts to beat faster, and then the king slowly reaches out to a silk cushion next to him, on which is a golden scepter, and with a smile, he extends it to you. And you quickly reach out and you touch the tip, and you know that your life has been spared. Okay, you can open your eyes. That was Esther. That was her experience. That's chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. And archaeologists have discovered two carvings from this period of the Persian Empire that picture that axeman standing behind the throne, ready to end the life of anyone who had the temerity just to gatecrash the king's presence without his permission. So the big question was, what was going to be extended to you? The scepter or the axe? Going to be one of the two if you want to walk in. And the axe was a real risk, a genuine risk for Esther. As we've already seen in this book, the king, King Ahasuerus, was impulsive and shallow and cruel, perfectly happy to have people executed without a second thought, as we've seen. And he already got rid of the previous queen before Esther because she ticked him off. And Esther may have been his current queen, but as we saw last week in chapter 4, he hadn't wanted anything to do with her for a month now. And so death was a very real possibility for her. And that brings us to the first of two things that Esther shows us a part of putting God first in your life, and that is courage. Esther knew she was breaking the law, or at least taking a massive risk by walking into his presence uninvited. As she said at the end of chapter 4 last week, if I perish, I perish. She was ready to die. But her courage goes even deeper, because everything she's done so far, that walk through the palace, going through the doorway, waiting to see, am I going to get the axe or the scepter? All of that was only the first part of the danger. The second, and maybe the bigger part of the danger, is what comes next. Because what comes next is that she's got to ask the king to abolish the law that Haman put in place to wipe out the Jews. The same law that was backed by the king's blessing and planned with the king's prime minister and sealed with the king's signet ring. In other words, she's asking the king, probably the most prideful man on the planet, if you've read the book so far, to humiliate himself with a big U-turn and lose face. That is just something Ahasuerus does not do. In addition, she's asking for legislation to be cancelled that, by definition, as we'll find out later in the book, can't be cancelled. She's meddling in legal matters way over her head. In the king's mind, she's eye candy. She's a trophy wife. What is she doing getting involved in this? In addition, she's asking the king to swallow a loss of 10,000 talents of silver, which is how much this genocide has cost. Chapter 3, verse 9. That is crazy money, even by the king's standards. That is about half the annual tax revenue for the entire empire. She's asking the king to take that loss. In addition, this is my last in addition, just trying to show the extent of the craziness of what she's even contemplating asking him. In addition, her request will mean revealing her own secret identity as a Jew, thus admitting to her husband that she's been deceiving him for 5 years. They've been married for 5 years at this point. And all of this to a man who routinely would have had people killed for way less. Like, talk about sticking your head in the lion's mouth. This is courage off the charts. In John 14, Jesus says to his disciples, "Do not let your hearts be troubled. Do not be afraid." 2 Timothy 1, Paul says to Timothy, "God gave you a spirit not of fear, but of power and love and self-control." 1 Corinthians 16, Paul says to the Corinthians, "Stand firm in the faith, be courageous, be strong." In the 1950s and 60s, Nikita Khrushchev was the premier of the Soviet Union. And throughout that time, he violently denounced Russia's previous evil dictator, Joseph Stalin. And one time, as Khrushchev was criticizing Stalin in a public meeting, he was interrupted by a shout from the back of the crowd. And someone yelled, "But you were one of his colleagues. Why didn't you stop him?" And apparently Khrushchev roared, "Who said that?" And there was this agonizing silence across the crowd as no one dared move a muscle. And then Khrushchev replied quietly, "Now you know why." Not caving to pressure at work to go along with illegal or immoral practices which dishonor Christ takes courage. Sharing the gospel with colleagues or friends or family members who may take offense at you takes real courage. Standing by what the Bible says about sex and gender, especially when it means being criticized or mocked or losing friends or even being disciplined at school or in the workplace, takes courage. Parenting children and teenagers Christianly, even when they may not like that in the moment, takes real courage. And even when we're with fellow believers who we love and care about, gently, respectfully calling out the God-dishonoring humor or the ungodly gossip of those who should know better, that takes real courage. Remember Esther. Let's be brave. God is worth it. But in addition to courage, there's a second thing Esther displays here that we also need if we're serious about being faithful as God's people, and that is this: wisdom. Wisdom. Esther isn't just brave, she's smart with it. This is a killer combo. She's amazing. Brave, off the charts, and yet incredibly smart with it. When the king asks what she wants, she replies, verse 4, "If it please the king." Literally in the Hebrew, "if it is good for the king." So she's framing her request from the outset in terms of what's in the king's best interests. She's not being naive. She's a good negotiator. She's being smart. Reading from verse 4 again. "If it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I've prepared for the king." Now, by inviting Haman as well, Esther is doing something of utter genius. And this is going to come home to roost in chapter 7 later. But the feast isn't her true request, and the king knows the feast isn't her true request. What she's doing is skillfully softening the ground. She's setting the conditions for success. We've already seen how this king loves a feast, loves a drink. She's being smart. So they have the feast, and then she waits, and she waits. And she doesn't say anything. She forces him to be the first to speak, the first to ask. And eventually, he is the one who again asks what her real request is, verse 6. And she invites him to another feast. So again, she softens the ground. Again, she paves the way. Again, she continues to play him like a big fish, patiently, skillfully, happy to slowly reel him in without him even noticing. And by adding yet this second feast, kind of forcing him to ask a second time what the request is, getting him to repeat a second time his slightly thoughtless promise of anything up to half the kingdom, just an expression, she's gradually making it harder and harder and harder for him to say no. She's playing it beautifully. So do we see again and again how wise and smart and skillful she's being in all of this? The Bible does not encourage us to manipulate each other in a deceitful or cynical way for our own ends. But in Luke 16, Jesus, in the parable of the manager, does tell us to be shrewd in how we deal with the people of this world. Proverbs 16 does remind us of how, quote, the heart of the wise makes his speech judicious and adds persuasiveness to his lips. In Ephesians 6, Paul does say, let no corrupting talk come out of your mouths, but only such as is good for building up as fits the occasion. That takes real smarts. That takes wisdom. What fits the occasion? Is this the time and the place to say this thing? That it may give grace to those who hear. So yes, we need courage, but how we approach tricky situations, whether out in the world or within our Emmanuel family, often requires real thought. How can I say this thing gently and respectfully and kindly? How can I say it accurately? How can I say this thing so that the other person feels respected and knows that I love them, even if I disagree with them? How can I say it in such a way that all of their defenses don't immediately go up? I could just fire a zippy soundbite at them and have the satisfaction of venting, but how can I say this thing that's going to be more productive? Sure, there's a time and a place for courage and courageous verbal force. You know, Matthew 3, John calls people, you bunch of snakes. Matthew 25, Jesus tells people to go to hell. Galatians 5, Paul says he wishes his enemies would castrate themselves. And there's a place for that, and sometimes that's right. And maybe occasionally, a few times in our lives, when it's appropriate to speak like that, we're cowardly, we're chickens, we duck out of that. But so often, being wise and smart and thoughtful and restrained and persuasive with our words does so much more to honor God and edify others and get more done for the kingdom. When I was growing up, I used to really enjoy Aesop's Fables. You guys come across Aesop's Fables? These tales from ancient Greece about teaching lessons about wisdom. And in one of these, the wind and the sun are having an argument one day. And they're arguing about who's stronger. And they look down at that moment and they see a traveler far below them on the earth walking along with a cloak. And the sun says, look, let's use that guy to find out. Let's see who can get his cloak off him. You go first. And so the wind starts to blow harder and harder until there's a hurricane roaring around the man. But the more violently the wind tries to rip his cloak off him, the tighter the guy clings and wraps his cloak around him. And at last the wind is exhausted and gives up. And then the sun smiles, starts to shine with all the heat he can muster, and very quickly the man just takes off his cloak. Esther was more like the sun than the wind. For the sake of the kingdom, for the sake of getting things done, being productive, edifying others, honoring God, moving things forward, let's be likewise. That's Esther. Then finally, and this is quicker, we move on to Haman. And what the author is showing us about Haman is very simple, and it's pride. Pride. Haman is consumed with this out-of-control, self-worshipping, self-destructive pride. Now, he's flying high because of all the special treatment he seems to be getting, with these invitations to private banquets with just the king and the queen, when Mordecai rains on his parade. I love it. Halfway through verse 9, Mordecai's just that fly in the ointment for Haman, isn't he? Halfway through verse 9, but when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Now, Haman is so into himself. He worships himself so much. His ego cannot cope with Mordecai not trembling before him when he walks past. So he goes home and he nurses his ego in a way which is so pathetic, it is almost embarrassing to read. He sends for his wife and his friends and they all sit around him. And verse 11, Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches. the number of his sons, thinking his wife probably knew about the number of the sons she'd given birth to. She probably remembered that. He goes on and on boasting like an insecure three-year-old about his achievements and how he's been advanced. And his grand climax is the fact that he's been invited to this private feast again tomorrow. Now, we know what's on the menu for the feast the next day, and it is the mother of all blindsides going to be delivered by Esther. And she's going to lower the boom on him in a spectacular way. Do not miss next Sunday. But he doesn't see this. So it's like we're watching Haman going on and on about how amazing he is and how perfect everything is, but we're sort of watching like this. But even despite all of this self-soothing egomania on steroids, Haman still cannot let it go. Verse 19, 13, he says, he circles back. Yet all this is worth nothing to me, so long as I see Mordecai, the Jew, sitting at the king's gate. And then I can imagine Haman being very Haman and saying, but enough about me. What do you think about me? And so to comfort him, his wife, Zeresh, comes up with this grotesque plan to have this gallows built, 50 cubits high. That is 75 feet high. That is way taller than this building. That's like a 9-floor skyscraper in his own backyard just for Mordecai. And that is the literally towering extent of his pride, that when it's bruised, it should produce such rage as to require such spectacular revenge. He's a monster. We would never be like that, would we? Sure, we don't have his power, his unbridled freedom to act, to let his natural human nature just be unrestrained. We might not be as extreme as him, but think about it. Haman has everything, right? He's wealthy beyond any of our wildest dreams. He's like, you know, Bill Gates in the empire in terms of his personal wealth. He's powerful, second only to the king. There is just one thing he can't have. He has everything except for one thing, which is Mordecai groveling. And therefore, he can't be happy. In the words of one Christian writer, how often do we live functionally saying, look, God, yes, you've forgiven my sins. Yes, you've poured your Holy Spirit out on your church. Yes, you've opened up eternal life and I'll live forever in glory. Yes, you've set me free. But I will not be happy until you've given me a boyfriend, a girlfriend, a job, promotion. I will not be happy until my friends, my kids are flourishing. I will not be happy until I'm thinner, until you give me that girl even though she's not my wife, that guy even though he's not my husband, that thrill that you've put out of my reach. See, there is a little bit of Haman in all of us. And it comes down to pride. It comes down to worshiping myself. The mindset is to think, I'm the most important. That's what Haman thought. And so if God has chosen to withhold from me something, and I think he's wrong to, I'm just going to reach out and take it. Sorry, God. Because I won't be happy unless I can have it. Again, just like Haman. But as I finish, I need to say there is a solution to this. There is hope, and his name is Jesus Christ. Because of Jesus Christ, we can say with Paul to the Philippians, I have learned in whatever situation I am in to be content. Contentment is found in Jesus. It's Christ who's the key to happiness and fulfillment, not having every last thing I ever want, which God maybe hasn't appointed for me. It's Christ who's worthy of all of our worship, not worshiping ourselves. That instinct to worship is hardwired into us, but when we direct it at ourselves, horrific things happen. We direct it to Christ where it belongs. It's Christ who gives us the ultimate example of that humility that Haman didn't have. As Jesus didn't count equality with God a thing to be grasped, though he could have, had a right to, but he humbled himself even to death. In fact, even to death on a cross. And it's Christ who, by that death, satisfies God's devastating justice for all the times we have done a Haman, even if on a smaller scale. And not only is Christ the antidote to Haman, he's also the fulfillment of Esther. It's Christ who's the one of ultimate courage, who didn't just risk perishing for the people, who actually perished for the people. The one who didn't just have wise words, the one who was the word, wisdom himself. And Esther didn't know whether she would be able to walk into the king's presence and be accepted by him to advocate for her people, whereas Christ did know that he definitely would be accepted by his Father to advocate for his people, and that's exactly what he's done for us. 1 John chapter 2 begins, "We have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous." He's the true and better Esther, walking into the king's presence and saving us. The analogy is not exact. His Father planned with him to save us, but you can see the parallel. And so as we seek to take up Esther's courage and Esther's wisdom, and as we seek to fight Haman's pride in us, the place to look, as always, is Jesus Christ.